Okay. Before the latest doctor in the Good Shepherd mission comes to read the passage to us, did you realize that if you're an adult in this church and you're called Tim, you have to be a doctor? Not necessarily a medical doctor. What are you a doctor of, Tim? What are you a doctor of? Physics, there we are. If you're concerned about the Earth's gravitational pull or why the chair stays upright when you sit on it, Tim's your man. So before... Sorry? That too. Very good. Anyway, a few words of explanation. So please do look up page 1162. So, today we are doing a small series. We're starting a small series in two books of the Bible. Now, I've been a Christian since the 1930s. I can't remember ever having heard a series on these two books of the Bible. They're 2 John and 3 John, two very small books, right at the end of the New Testament. I thought I'd read out what my commentary says about these two books. So this is what it says. This sets the scene. The gospel was continuing to spread rapidly. House churches were springing up throughout the Greco-Roman world. The writings of the apostles were beginning to circulate among them, but the apostles themselves had all but died out. It seems more than likely that John was the only remaining member of the original group of 12 apostles. The careful oversight of the church depicted in the Acts of the Apostles was no longer possible. At the same time, traveling preachers and missionaries were increasing. But their message did not always ring true to the gospel the apostles had preached. Some people claimed new insights, taking them beyond the teaching of the apostles, which was caricatured as primitive and unsophisticated. There was a fullness of knowledge and experience that these new teachers had, and which they were willing to pass on to others at a price. The temptation to join this spiritual elite must have proved very strong. Others wanted to go back to the Old Testament, to the purity of the law and circumcision. The most pressing question was how these young churches were to be kept strong in the true faith and how they were to maintain their priorities with both unswerving orthodoxy and vigorous spiritual life. That is why these two short letters were inspired, written, and preserved in the New Testament canon. That's the background. I'm going to cover the first section of 2 John today, and then the other Dr. Tim is going to cover the rest of this letter next week, and then Mike is going to cover 3 John the following week. I think you are, aren't you? Very good. One further point of explanation before the other Dr. Tim comes to read verses 1 to 6 of 2 John. When you hear him read it, you'll see this passage is addressed to the lady chosen by God and her children. For reasons I can't quite work out, commentators think this doesn't refer to an actual woman, to an actual lady, but to a church. So the church is the lady, and her children mean the Christians who formed part of that church. Not sure why it's put like that, but that's what the commentators say, and I'm happy to trust in their scholarship and agree that John is writing not to an actual lady, but to a church and its members. Over to Dr. Tim to come up and read verses 1 to 6.
The elder, to the lady chosen by God and to her children, whom I love in the truth, and not I only, but also all who know the truth, because of the truth which lives in us and will be with us forever. Grace, mercy, and peace from God the Father and from Jesus Christ the Father's Son will be with us in truth and love. It has given me great joy to find some of your children walking in the truth, just as the Father commanded us. And now, dear lady, I am not writing you a new command, but one we have had from the beginning. I ask that we love one another. And this is love, that we walk in obedience to his commands. As you have heard from the beginning, his command is that you walk in love.
Thank you very much indeed. I have a hard message for us this morning. When I tell you what it is, you may think I'm being silly calling it hard. But the more I've thought about this, the more I've thought on my own failure to live up to it, and it's brought me to reflection and repentance in my life. So here it is, here's the message. We are to love one another. That's all. That's today's takeaway. Christians are to love one another. So verses 5 and 6, I'm not writing you a new command, but one we've had from the beginning. I ask that we love one another, and this is love, that we walk in obedience to his commands. As you have heard from the beginning, his command is that you walk in love. Maybe we don't see loving each other as too much of a problem. Last weekend I was in Victoria Park, and a man walked past me with a t-shirt that said, "Choose love." How nice. We should love each other. That's a nice, easy thing to agree, isn't it? Churches are full of nice people doing nice things. What's the problem? Well, here's the problem. Here's one of the most famous sayings of Jesus, and it's from the Gospel of John. There we are. A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another. Jesus says to his disciples that the way people will know that they are his disciples is by loving each other. Now, if you look at that, it's kind of obvious, isn't it? It's only when Jesus' disciples do something different from the world around them, when their love reaches a certain level, that the world around will know that they're Jesus' disciples. If all they're doing is what the world around them is doing, there's nothing to show that they're Jesus' disciples. That's the standard of love that Jesus' disciples are called to. And it's the same standard that John mentions in this letter this morning. This is a command we have had from the beginning, he says. This is the command that Jesus gave us, that we love one another so that people will know that we are Jesus' disciples. And that means loving one another more than the world around is doing. So then I got to thinking, well, what is the standard of love in the world around us? Well, here we go, two examples. Firstly, the street I live in, some of the rest of you do as well. Sharon Gardens in Hackney, hashtag best street in London. What characterizes our street? Well, it seems to me that it's full of nice people. During the pandemic, one of our neighbors helped cook for one of the families in the street where the mother of the family was very unwell. Another neighbor would bring out his laptop and speakers and take requests from everyone on the street WhatsApp and have a kind of open-air jukebox to the extent that the restrictions allowed, and sometimes to a little bit more than the restrictions allowed. We get together once or twice a year for parties, for picnics, or such like. We get agreement with the council to close the road a few times a year so the kids can play in the street. It's a bit like Nappy Valley, the street. It's lots of young kids. So we close the road so they can play in the street and so they can go trick-or-treating at Halloween. We look out for each other. Our family, as lots of you know, is currently in rented accommodation round the corner from the street while some work is being done on our house. And our landlord are some of the neighbours in our street who are being extraordinarily generous in the rent that they're demanding. Those in the street are very welcoming to newcomers. and they'll reach out to those who are having a hard time or who are grieving. There's a so-called women's book club in the street. I say so-called because I'm not sure how much they discuss books. But anyway, I'm told that everyone there gets on really well. And then there's the usual stuff. We're always taking each other's Amazon deliveries. Teenagers from the street will babysit younger children of other families on the street. We're in and out of each other's houses. We're sharing recycling bags, all the usual stuff. Sounds nice, doesn't it? Sounds nice. It is nice. On the downside, if you act aggressively or in other ways wind up other neighbours, or if there is a property dispute, it can get pretty awkward. Now, there are at least four evangelical Christian households on the street. Three from this church, the Rowles, the McIlwains, and us, and someone who's the minister at East London Tabernacle as well. And maybe there are more. Maybe there are more. How are Christians in that environment to love each other in a way that is distinctive? How will people know in that environment that we are Jesus' disciples? Second example. Okay, let's have some fun with flags. Who wants to guess which country that is the flag of? Nope.
Kenya.
Yes! Full marks to Terry. I act as a trustee of a charity that helps very poor people in some sub-Saharan countries in Africa access personal savings and loans because, by and large, banks don't want to deal with very poor people in sub-Saharan Africa. They'd rather deal with very rich people. One of my fellow trustees is a man called James, who's a professor of international development at one of the British universities. He tells me that in Kenya, many people don't deal with banks at all, even if the banks are happy, willing to deal with them. These people don't want the banks to be earning money from their savings while their savings are sitting in their account. They'd rather put their money to work. So what James tells me is that the people in Kenya, in these communities, invest in relationships. They lend the money or give the money to their friends, to their family, to their neighbors, to build up goodwill and favors that they can then call on when they themselves face difficulty. Sounds impressive, doesn't it? Sounds impressive. Now, these aren't Christians doing this. It's just the cultural norm in certain parts of Kenya. Maybe that logic works in the UK as well. Now, here, of course, we are more likely to use banks to keep what money we have, but we might also lend it to friends and family on the basis of kind of you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. How can Christians love each other in such a way that they stand out in that sort of financially supportive environment? Because, guys, here's my fear. Here's my fear. Unless we stand out, unless we go beyond what we see in society around us, what will we be saying to our unbelieving family, friends, and neighbors? That you can come along on a Sunday morning to a nice, mutually supportive group of men and women, like you might find on a nice London street, or a group of friends that help each other out financially. That's not a compelling message. That's not compelling if that's what they see around them already in their street, in their community. Only when we show the world God's love in action by loving each other in the same way that God loved us will we persuade people that there is something that transforms lives rather than something they might find in their street or friendship group. Jesus calls us to love our Christian brothers and sisters as he has loved us, in the same way that he loved us. So what does the Bible mean when it says that we have to love each other as Christians? Well, how can we practically do what John is telling us to do here? Well, I want to suggest two ways we can love each other in this church that will stand out and that we're called to as Christians. Just two ways. If we do these things, people will take notice. In his Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, "Let your light shine before men, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven." How is our light going to shine in a way that isn't seen in the world around us? So firstly, first of these two ways, we forgive each other. In every society, there are rules. They may be written, they may be unwritten. In our street, in Sharon Gardens, our relationships are based on everyone acting acceptably to the others. People generally don't step out of line, because if they do, there is a reckoning to be had. Some neighbours have fallen out over things that have gone on between adjoining properties. Someone making too much noise, someone doing something to damage their neighbour's house. Others have been rude about others on the street, and word has got around. These things linger. There can be bad blood for a while between different households, because when someone has wronged you, you want there to be a making right. You want there to be a recompense. They have wronged you, they now owe you, and they need to make good what they have harmed. You will hold that over them until they do. Christians are not to act in that way between each other. And here's the challenge. I will wind you up, I will hurt you, and you will do the same to me. Almost inevitably, because we're all fallen humans. And also because the gospel knits our lives together in a way that wouldn't happen outside a Christian community. I can be a right idiot at times. I'm looking around for Jo. I think she's out teaching TOS. There are times when you will need to decide whether to forgive me or not. Should it be that way? No. I should be holy and perfect and like Jesus, right? I should. Then you wouldn't need to forgive me at all. And as I go on in my Christian life, my prayer is that God makes me more like Jesus. But I'm a work in progress, and so are you. When we hurt each other, when we offend each other, when we disappoint each other, we have a choice to make. Do we hold on to our bitterness and blame, or do we let go? The world only forgives when things are made right. Christian forgiveness does not wait for things to be made right. It's costly and it's hard, and because of that, the world will take notice when they see it. Because it looks different, it looks costly and hard. The world will wonder why we're doing it. The world will wonder what we've got that they haven't got. There's a really striking example of this in a book by Francis Schaeffer called The Mark of the Christian. And I'm going to read out quite a long section to you because it made a big impression on me. I hope it does to you too. This is what happened in the Brethren churches in Germany during and after the Second World War. So Brethren Church is a particular group of Christians. So this is what Francis Schaeffer says in his book about these Brethren churches in Germany. In order to control the church, Hitler commanded the union of all religious groups in Germany, drawing them together by law. The Brethren divided over this issue. Half accepted Hitler's dictum and half refused. The ones who submitted, of course, had a much easier time. But gradually, in this organizational oneness with the liberal groups, their own doctrinal sharpness and spiritual life withered. On the other hand, the group that stayed out remained spiritually virile, but there was hardly a family in which someone did not die in a German concentration camp. Now, can you imagine the emotional tension? The war is over, and these Christian brothers face each other again. They had the same doctrine, and they had worked together for more than a generation. Now, what is going to happen? One man remembers that his father died in a concentration camp, and knows that these people over here remain safe. But people on the other side have deep personal feelings as well. Then gradually these brothers came to know that this situation just would not do. A time was appointed when the elders of the two groups could meet together in a certain quiet place. I asked the man who told me this, "What did you do?" And he said, "Well, I'll tell you what we did. We came together and we set aside several days in which each man would search his own heart." Here was a real difference between the two groups. The emotions were deeply, deeply stirred. My father has gone to the concentration camp. My mother was dragged away. These things are not just little pebbles on the beach. They reach into the deep wellsprings of human emotions. But these people understood the command of Christ at this place. And for several days, every man did nothing except search his own heart concerning his own failures and the commands of Christ. Then they met together. I asked the man, "What happened then?" He said, "We were just one." Those who'd stood firm against Hitler's orders united with those who had stayed safe and given in. There was no bitterness. There was only forgiveness. That made a big impression on Francis Schaeffer, and it made a big impression on me when I read it. That sort of forgiveness, friends, deciding not to blame or hold a grudge, is something the world notices. Here's the other way in which we let our light shine before men by loving each other. We give sacrificially to each other. This is what it says in the previous book to the one we're looking at this morning, 1 John. This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. If anyone has material possessions and sees a brother or sister in need but has no pity on them, how can the love of God be in that person? Dear children, let us not love with words or speech, but with actions and in truth. So I don't know about you. When I hear that command to lay down my life for other Christians, I instinctively think of some heroic scene where terrorists burst in and demand that someone steps forward to sacrifice themselves on behalf of others. And I summon up my courage, and I step forward, and forever my heroism is remembered. Now, there's an awful lot of vanity tied up in that, and a fair bit of pride too. And in this country, that situation is fortunately pretty unlikely. But laying down my life for other Christians at the moment is more likely to be something more mundane. Laying down parts of my life that I'd rather keep for myself. My money, my home, my free time. These are all precious to me. How are we to do this in a way that is distinctive? I mentioned what goes on in Kenya and other societies where people give to each other in the knowledge that others will support them when they are themselves in need. That sort of approach builds relationship, but it's transactional. If I do good to you, then you are obliged to do good to me. It means that when you support others, you're more likely to support others who can support you back. Otherwise, you're wasting your money. You're not investing wisely. The Christian way is different to that. How will our giving of our time, our homes, and our money stand out? Well, it won't stand out if we support our family. Because lots of people do that. Lots of people will support their children, you know, the bank of mum and dad, all that sort of stuff. That's quite common. It won't stand out if we do that. It won't stand out if we support those who we know will pay us back and build up that sort of transactional relationship. Again, that's not uncommon. Now, the Christian way of loving our brothers and sisters is by giving our time, our money, and our homes to those who will never be able to repay, never be able to support us back. giving anonymously, if possible, so the recipient doesn't know who has supported them, giving to those who can't repay. Then, when that recipient is asked by their friends and their families who provided them with the support they need, they can say, well, it was my Christian brothers and sisters, but I don't know which ones. Then the world takes notice. Visiting the lonely, spending time reaching out to others in crisis where all the effort is one way, making space in your home for others who are in need of housing. Again, the world takes notice. Why would Christians do that, the world thinks? What do they get out of it? What is driving these Christians to act in this loving way towards each other? What have they got that I haven't? We are to love each other in a way that stands out so that the world will know we are Jesus' disciples. We are to forgive each other when we are wronged. We are to give sacrificially to our brothers and sisters of our time, of our homes, and of our money, not in order to build up goodwill or get support back, but just because that's what we are to do. It's hard because it's unfair. It's one way. It's unusual for those reasons. It will stand out. And did you notice the language used in verses 5 and 6 of this morning's passage? Look at that. I'm not writing you a new command, but one that we have had from the beginning. I ask that we love one another, and this is love, that we walk in obedience to his commands. As you've heard from the beginning, his command is that you walk in love. A new command, walk in obedience to his commands. His command is that you walk in love. Loving each other isn't something you aspire to like a New Year's resolution. It's not a nice idea. It's a command from a superior officer. Not to do that is sin. It's rebellion against God. It's a command. It's not optional. It's not an optional extra. How do we do this? Well, I'd like to show you a clip from a film from 1998 from Les Miserables. Fortunately, not the musical. Many of you will know the story maybe from the musical, but I'll fill you in. So Jean Valjean is the central character of Victor Hugo's novel, played in the film here by Liam Neeson. He's been discharged from prison, and he's been taken in by a priest who's played here by Peter Vaughan. And the priest has given Jean Valjean food and a bed. And the clip starts in the middle of the night as Jean Valjean gets up to steal the valuables of the priest. Jean Valjean steals from the priest and assaults him. He's caught by the police and returned to the priest. What will the priest do? Well, rather than condemn the man for assaulting him and stealing his silver, the priest insists that Valjean takes the silver and also the other precious items he has, the silver candlesticks. He then tells Valjean that this is to be when his life turns from looking for opportunities to steal and be violent to being good. And it changes Valjean completely. He realizes the trouble he was in if the priest complains. He'd be straight back on the prison ships, condemned to hard labor for the rest of his life. He's in a desperate situation. But rather than condemn him, the priest gives him riches. It blows his mind. It changes him. It turns his life around. How much are our minds blown by what Jesus did for us? How much are our minds blown by what Jesus did for us? The only way in which we can forgive others and give sacrificially is if we understand how much more Jesus did that for us. In that clip, Jean Valjean, he's facing destruction and he's given riches. We were facing destruction, we were given riches. Do we realize this? Do we have a handle on this? Do we realize what our situation was before Jesus saved us? Tim Keller summed up the gospel this way. The gospel is this: we are more sinful and flawed in ourselves than we ever dared believe. Yet at the very same time, we are more loved and accepted in Jesus Christ than we ever dared hope. We were facing hell, God's righteous anger against us because of our rebellion against him, because of our selfishness. But Jesus took all that hell and righteous anger so that we would be given riches, like Jean Valjean being given the silver candlesticks. How can we love each other in a way that is distinctive? How can we forgive others because Jesus brought us forgiveness? Ephesians 4, be kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving each other just as in Christ God forgave you. We forgive because we have been forgiven. How can we give sacrificially to others? Because Jesus gave sacrificially to us. 2 Corinthians 9, for you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you through his poverty might become rich. To the extent that we understand how Jesus brought about our forgiveness, we will forgive others. To the extent that we understand how Jesus gave sacrificially to us, we will give sacrificially to others. Asking someone to forgive and give sacrificially, commanding, if you please, Christians to love each other is a big ask. We can't do it if we don't realize that what we're commanded to do is a pale reflection of what Jesus has already done for us. When we do it, the world will notice, the world will wonder why.